If you're hearing this, it means tickets are now on sale for our streaming Cybactacular.
That's what we're calling the streaming show of our Star Trek V review that we toured last year. We filmed our Hollywood show, and it's going to be streaming on Thursday, May 16th at 7 p.m. Eastern Time. And the stream will be available for a couple of weeks after that. If you can't watch right at the premiere time. A couple of pieces of information about this. If you support us at MaximumFun.org/join and your membership is current, check your email inbox because Maximum Fun will have emailed you a promo code to get $5 off your ticket. And also, we have some VIP packages available that include a meet and greet with me and Adam. Those are going fast, so jump on that if you want a meet and greet VIP package. Again, it's greatestgentour.com to get your tickets for the streaming Cybactacular.
My friends, the great experiment.
The greatest trick. Hidden trick.
Would you look at that?
The greatest trick.
And you people, you're all astronauts on some kind of Star Trek.
Welcome to Greatest Trek. It's a new Star Trek podcast from the makers of The Greatest Generation. I'm Ben Harrison.
I'm Adam Pranica, and this is pilot season.
Pilot season, nearing a close, nearing a conclusion.
It feels good to finally have a show with pilots in it. Like actual pilots. That's
yeah,
good.
That's fair. Yeah, we're wrapping it up with a bang. This is the first of a two-parter of pilot season. We've been going back through sci-fi from the mid-90s to mid-2000s and watching pilot episodes. And,
right.
This is one of those, like, it was a TV movie that they were like, let's see if the TV movie gets any traction, and if it does, we'll take it to series kind of TV movies.
And boy, oh boy, did this one get traction. This one was like the highest rated show on sci-fi that year, and I think the highest rated show they ever aired for several years.
Wow.
Was this miniseries.
Good for them.
Yeah. Check out the knobby tires on this pilot. Pure traction, yeah. Baby. Did you see it when it dropped?
Did not. I probably watched it on like DVD a few years later.
So this wasn't completely new to you?
No, I think... But I'm not sure if I watched the miniseries. I think I might have just gotten like the DVDs of the first season and watched that because I didn't really remember any of this stuff.
I definitely missed it when it initially came out and I ended up catching it on streaming.
Yeah.
And this was like one of the rare instances where my wife actually proposed watching this and like reminded me of her hard sci-fi bona fides, you know? Like,
yeah.
She was down. She encouraged this.
Man.
And I'm glad she did because, like, once we started with the miniseries, we absolutely motored through the rest of it, for sure. And like, there's a lot of it to binge out there.
There sure is. Yeah, this is one of those franchises that really had staying power. I mean, this is like a reboot of a reboot, right?
Yeah.
There was two previous series of Battlestar.
I mean, and they had attempted to create not just reboots, but like subsequent series to the story.
Right.
And those ended up not really getting anywhere until the idea for this came around.
Yeah. And this spawned its own series of, like Caprica is a Battlestar thing, right?
It is. Yeah. Yeah.
And is that a prequel series?
It is.
Yeah. See, I never seen any of this stuff.
Oh, you got to, Ben. You have so much to watch now that we're reaching the end of pilot season.
Yeah. I tried to watch further episodes of a couple of these series and just couldn't bring myself.
I've got higher hopes for this one for you. I think it's pretty addictive.
So, I lost my job.
Oh. One more episode?
Yeah.
I remember getting really annoyed by the doctor character with the first season. Like, just
this
kind
is...
of kind of constantly, you know, turning away from everyone and going into his fugue states or whatever. I remember he just really rubbed me the wrong way as a writing flourish.
I mean, hard to beat Gaius Baltar in the looks department, Ben.
He's hunky. He's easy on the eyes. You can see why he can attract a lady as great looking as the one he does, despite being such a worm, you know?
I mean, he could probably attract all types of women. No robo.
Yeah, I mean, I would say that as problematic as it is, no robo is kind of the the raison d'etre of humanity in this show.
Sure is.
Maybe we should get into it.
Can't wait, Ben. Interesting detail about when this episode dropped. The day after Pearl Harbor Day.
Wow.
December 8th, 2003 is when our ninth episode of pilot season finds itself. It's the Battlestar Galactica miniseries. And in this episode of Greatest Trek, we're going to cover part one.
You know the greatest danger facing us is an irrational fear of the unknown.
I haven't seen one of these in about 20 years.
I think part of the reason I like this so much is like the Ronald D. Moore-ness of it. It seems like his writing DNA is something that I find very pleasing in my sci-fi.
It's real Ronald D. Moore-y.
Yeah.
And,
yep.
Yeah, I mean, I'm glad that that guy's still out there making shows.
Yeah.
I haven't watched all of For All Mankind, but I've watched like the first couple of seasons and really enjoyed. And
oh,
been meaning
you got
to catch back up.
I'm laughing because there are some parts of it that are unintentionally funny, but not a deterrent in any way.
Yeah.
By saying that.
We open with some kind of, you know, on-screen text describing the Cylon War and how this was a bad thing that happened to humanity 40 years ago. And this is not Earth humanity. This is humanity of the colonies of Kobol. Is that right?
Yeah, I think you got that.
Something like that. Colonial humanity. And that's kind of intercutting with this ship docking at a space station, which we are led to believe is the station where humanity kind of holds a vigil to maintain diplomatic relations with the Cylons, which is what the robots are called. And the Cylons never show up.
I mean, are they really relations if it's just one person showing up for the date for 40 years? And it made me wonder whether this was the guy who got to do it every year. Like, this diplomat who works the station, he's got his tchotchkes on the desk, pictures of his family and so forth. It seems like a kind of lived-in place for how sparse it is.
Yeah.
You know? Imagine this is your job. And imagine you've been doing this for 40 years and the door finally opens on the other side. What a shock.
It's a total shock. What did you make of this guy? Because you get a couple of images of him and I couldn't tell if they were trying to old up a younger actor or if he was just supposed to look crusty.
You're talking about the milky eyes?
The milky eyes, and there's like crust around his mouth, and he's like got, it seems like there's like that, you know, that technique where you stretch somebody's skin out around their eyes and then paint on latex makeup and then
Let
it dry.
There was famously an entire Next Generation movie about that technique, right?
Exactly.
Yeah, there is a quality to old man mouth crust, isn't there?
Yeah.
That is deeply troubling. I don't like it. Especially when you see what this guy does with that mouth.
Yeah, like when she asks him, "Are you alive?" I'm like, is he?
Is that a boner question?
Oh, like, did it move is the translation?
Yeah.
Don't wait for the translation. Answer me now.
He doesn't really know how to answer that. He's not used to anyone walking through those doors, let alone, we should describe what we're seeing here. The Cylons are robot people, but this third figure is a lady, at least presents as a lady, and she's got a hot red dress on, and she's got blonde hair, and she doesn't sit at the desk where this diplomat is. She gets right on the other side of it and practically sits in this guy's lap before kissing him.
Practically sits on this guy's face, honestly.
Yeah.
It's a very horny sequence. He does have like a little printout showing what Cylons are supposed to look like.
Yeah.
And the ones that come through that don't look like hot blondes are a very highly updated edition of this.
Unclear whether they want to fuck also, or maybe they're just kind of waiting for her to start it off and then they're going to get into it after a little bit.
Uh-huh. I think that they're just waiting for her to distract her so that they can take his medicine.
I don't even know why the scientists make them.
I mean, they have those long fingers. They probably wouldn't have to walk very far across the room to get it.
Yeah,
because they're made of metal and robots are strong.
They look really cool. So we learn from her very little, but we learn it has begun. And then we cut to the outside while this makeout sesh is happening, and a very advanced looking spaceship missiles the space station and destroys it.
This is erotic symbolism, right? This is what's going on in that old man's pants.
Fucking shoot.
Like, there's the suggestion of rigidity there before it just completely folds over and explodes.
He tried.
Yeah. What a way to go out.
Yeah. Kind of a weird choice for the robots to make, right? Like hey, let's send an emissary to be mean to this one guy and then destroy them and him.
Yeah, it seems like an unnecessary amount of force against this one guy in this weak station.
So we cut over to our hero ship of the series, the Battlestar Galactica. You know, I think initially we don't get a great sense of the scale of this ship, but we do get a sense of how great this set is, because these are like long, unbroken shots where, you know, we start with Starbuck, who is one of our other stars, and she's like on a jog through the ship and runs through what looks like kind of like a media tour of the ship. Some kind of, you know, government or naval stooge is giving this tour and talking about all the things that the ship has that are interesting. This guy's name is Doral. He'll come up a few times over the course of the episode.
This is my favorite kind of story building here. Like, you're so right about this single shot floating around, but that we're just learning things incidentally because they happen to be occurring in these different parts of the ship.
Yeah.
I think is a great way to introduce things and people and the moment in time that we're in.
And it's like, man, what a big swing for this as a mini series to build a set this big, because like, you can't do a long one-er like this and have it be an interesting and effective shot if you have two hallways to use. Like, they have a great big set here.
Well, I don't know, I guess so.
We meet Adama, he's Commander Adama, but Commander seems to outrank Captain in this world.
Right.
We also meet some orange-suited engineering staff. We meet a lot of people over the course of this sequence.
There's a way that Adama is treated that I think is really important in these initial scenes. He's like, given the kind of respect and reverence of a guy who's been around the block for decades like him, but he's also not feared in these moments as a hard ass. Like, he seems to have a kind of open way of communicating with his subordinates that is not something that's taken advantage of. It's just something that's utilized by them.
Yeah, and you get the sense, like, he's kind of like going over this speech and muttering to himself, and gets an update from one of his subordinates about like a request that somebody go out and check on the diplomatic station because they haven't heard from it in a while. And he's like, well, today is busy. And the like tone of that is like, that's not going to be us, because like, obviously that's not going to be us.
Right. Because not only is Adama treated with like the respect conveyed to a heroic person who's being sunsetted, the ship is being treated the same way. Like, the ship's conversion into a museum makes it unfit for any kind of mission that isn't park around a planet and start tearing tickets for people.
Right.
But what's troubling about this moment is like the Al-Qaeda planning imminent attackness of the moment, like the report just being kind of dismissed.
Right. Yeah, that was his morning briefing, and he had an opportunity to do something right then and there.
Yeah. Yeah, instead of the briefing, he's shown the Mark II fighter in the fighter bay, and he's pretty psyched about this because it's the first time he's seen one of these in 20 years, and this one's done up in like his colors, and it's got his name on the side of the cockpit. And this is, I think, both given and received as a kind of gift for Adama.
Yeah. So there's this this main guy, Crew Chief Tyrol, and he seems to be sort of the, like, he's both the, like, head of engineering, but also seems to be kind of like head of the flight deck on this ship. He and a couple of his guys scrounged up this legendary old Viper fighter, and it's going to be part of the exhibit, but it's also going to take part in the commemoration.
She'll fly.
Oh, yes, sir.
It's an interesting trick that this episode pulls, because I think that by casting Edward James Olmos as Adama and by making the set look as vintage as it does, like, you know, we didn't talk about the bridge when we went in there, but like the bridge is huge, but it's also got some like real 70s flair to the way they mm-hmm. designed it. And the starfighters have some real 70s flair to them. It like feels old in the way that it needs to for there to be some gravitas, you know, like,
I mean, it's a magic trick when you're talking about the future's past, which is still ostensibly our future, you know?
Right. And like you're watching this guy kind of at the end of his jaunt as like a highly respected commander in this military. And like, we just met this guy. We're like less than 10 minutes into this episode. And it's like, man, like what a cool gesture that they did for him, you know?
I think it also works in this show's favor that even though the original Battlestar Galactica show was on TV after original series Star Trek, like they chose right in their fighter ship designs. Like this doesn't look like the shuttlecraft Galileo in the shuttle bay of the D. It doesn't look that out of place. It looks contextually right.
It looks great. And the fighter bay set is also like totally great. I think they're digitally expanding mm-hmm. it, making it look a lot bigger than it actually is. But the fact that there are full-size jets rolling around in there and like people can climb up a ladder and get into them,
mm-hmm.
it's something we remarked on in our bonus episode that we just dropped in the Max Fun bonus content feed. We reviewed a show called Space Above and Beyond, and it makes such a difference when they actually build the single flyer spaceship that mm-hmm. people are going to mm-hmm. use in the episode, you know?
Yeah. This is another one of those moments where it's very Picardian of Adama to like accept the generosity and love of his crew in this way, and not like a very like emotional scene for him, but clearly like he's touched by this. This is a good moment.
Yeah.
Thank you all. It's an honor.
They found an old picture of him with a couple of boys standing in front of this Viper. This is also a very touching moment. They do kind of biff this one where they make the classic film and television era of getting a punch in close up on the badly photoshopped image that would have, like, it would have just been fine to have like the medium shot of him mm-hmm. holding it and you can see it's yeah. a man and two boys and we'll do the math. But going in for that close up and laying bare how bad the Photoshop is on this is like one of those things that bumps me every single time.
If you can't be so much better than Forrest Gump at this, then you shouldn't try at all.
Just don't bother.
Yeah. Would you look at that? Speaking of being touched, there's a card game in the lower decks where Starbuck is playing with Colonel Teague, and you can tell from jump that they are two characters that do not like each other.
Starbuck.
Where'd you get that nickname anyway?
She wins big. And the problem with winning in a game like this, where there's already some frayed nerves, is that she's a sore winner also.
Yeah.
And she's needling him the whole time. And when he pushes over the table, does that dramatic table flip that is really like the dream, I think, in any argument.
Mm-hmm.
Never been able to do it. He flips that table and she punches him right in the face. And this seems to be something that he has wanted for a long time. She's been on his list to bust down to whatever. And in this case, bust down to the brig. Finally, she's given him the ammunition
yeah.
to send her away. And off to the brig she goes.
Colonel Teague is a character that we saw in our long oneer at the beginning of the episode, looking a little bit worse for wear, and starts this scene like tipping a flask into his cup of coffee.
Mm-hmm.
So he seems to be the, you know, second in command who's doing all the asshole shit that the big boss doesn't. Like, everybody loves and respects Adama, and basically everybody but Adama hates this guy's guts. And he's a drunk, and he probably kind of did this to goad Starbuck into smacking him so he could send her to the brig.
I don't find that anything really mixes with coffee in the way that Teague is doing this. Like, flask of whiskey or whatever in coffee, I don't like that very much.
Yeah, no, I don't think that Teague is doing it because it's, like, gustatorily advantageous.
Yeah. Yeah, his let's drink about it is they're about to decommission my ship, and I'm about to bust down Starbuck, finally, after decades of service.
Life events.
Colonel Teague, they've been pulling the big chair out for you for years, and you always turn it down because you want to keep serving under Adama, but also because you know that if you drink your ass off like this and are the actual commanding officer of a vessel... that's pretty dangerous.
I just got back not that long ago from a yearly golf trip I take with like 10 other dudes. And if you've ever wondered what that's like, an example of this is one of my buddies, you know, we get to the Airbnb and it's not been stocked yet. We don't have the basics. We don't even have coffee. But what we do have is all the booze we brought. And so my buddy, absent coffee, every morning just drank Kahlua. Just Kahlua in a mug. I thought it was the damnedest thing. Like, let's go get coffee, man. I want coffee. I don't want to drink Kahlua every morning. That's crazy.
Did he, like, pour Kahlua into a mug and then throw it in the microwave for a couple of minutes to warm it up?
Every morning, to the brim, Kahlua. Just amazing.
Next scene is Adama kind of trying to talk this dude out of pressing charges against Starbuck. And it's an interesting dynamic. Like, there does seem to be some respect between these men, even though Colonel Teague is, like, drunk at work.
Right.
You know?
Damn right I am. Heard you started the day off pretty early.
I mean, there is a geometry to the affection here that's interesting because, like, Teague and Adama are tight. Adama and Starbuck are tight. Teague and Starbuck are not.
Right.
And so, like, there's this dynamic here where Adama's like, come on, man. Like, really? What the fuck? And Teague's like, yeah, no, what the fuck?
Fuck me, right?
And Adama's point is like, could you, like, she's cool. She's cool with me. You can't be such a hard ass to her. She's like one of my best people and I really like her. That's kind of the takeaway here. Like, would you just do this for me? Because we're buds, not be such an asshole to her.
Yeah. So that is agreed. It's just going to be a let her cool off in the brig, but no charges pressed kind of a thing. And we cut to Caprica City, the capital, presumably, of Caprica, the planet. Lots of spaceships flying around. It's a cool, futuristic looking city.
Mm-hmm.
And we are in a big doctor's office under absolutely massive skylights.
It kind of looks like a fast food restaurant that used to have like the terrarium style, like,
oh, sure.
You know what I'm talking about? Like the greenhouse style area of the seating.
Yeah, they took all that out and put like an antique desk and chairs in there.
Right. This is no longer an Arby's.
The legend Mary McDonald sitting there, and a doctor comes in with some really bad news for her. She's got a lump, and like, we don't get like details on the lump.
Yeah, before he starts hissing at her really loudly. He's confused by this diagnosis.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, he's a snake man also.
Outside, it seems not that far away. Like, there's green spaces to these future cities, and this is one of them. This is the Caprica City Market, where we see the lady from the cold open just walking around amongst the people. She's not wearing the red dress anymore. She's trying to fit in. And her way of fitting in is noticing a mother with a baby in a stroller, which she is for some reason allowed to hold. And what's so great about this performance and the way this dialogue is written here is that the creepy shit she's saying isn't aggressively creepy. It is like whatever the creepy line is, two full steps back from that into like just kind of weird observation creepy, like clinically creepy.
Yeah.
So fragile.
Low-key, this scene really bespeaks what an ideal society this must be, because like somebody comes up to me and I've never met them before, even if they look like this lady, and ask to hold my baby, I'm like, nah, pause. Like, I don't know you. I'm not letting you pick my baby up, strange person. And it's like a bit of a weird thing about having a little baby. Like, there are people that just kind of feel entitled to reach out and touch the baby. And, I mean, Daron is now old enough that it's not really happening anymore. But really prided myself on, like, ducking and weaving out of the way when people reach out to try and put an unasked-for hand on him.
Yeah.
But, like, I was like, man, like, what kind of, like, society would I live in where I just trusted a stranger enough to be like, yeah, go ahead.
I would let this Cylon hold me today. And when she is allowed to pick up the baby, I mean, it doesn't get any more creepy than it was in the 30 seconds before. But what's tough is like when the mother's back is turned, you know, as the mom is like trying to get the attention of her husband or whatever.
Yeah.
A very elegantly blocked scene takes place where she kills this baby in the crib and you don't see it and you don't hear it. Crucially, I think this is really well done because
I heard a crack.
The trauma of the moment is in the reaction. And
yeah.
I think when bad things happen in movies and TV, those are the most powerful forms that they appear in, I think.
Yeah.
I didn't hear a crack. Were you teasing me?
I heard a crack.
You heard a baby's neck crack?
Yeah, I heard like a crack of the back level crack.
Oh, were you listening to this in headphones?
No.
Huh.
I didn't hear it. Just watching it on my television here in my office.
Maybe I was cracking my own back during.
That is, I would say likely you were cracking your back during.
Yeah,
you're like,
a lot.
Oh yeah, this scene. Oh, I love this. Oh, stretch it out.
Yeah.
It's so upsetting. I think the senselessness of it is what's upsetting.
But that's important for this character, right? The idea that the Cylon is moving through this society without the... Maybe she's aware of it, but absent any kind of feeling about the lives around her whatsoever. Like, these are fucking science experiments around her that she could perform whatever she wants on.
Right. She alludes to the fact that everybody's going to be dead pretty soon anyways, so, like, doesn't really matter. But just from, like, a trolley problem standpoint, like, she is magically splitting the trolley to go down both tracks.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Somebody make that meme.
We cut over to the palatial estate of Gaius Baltar. He's a famous scientist of some renown, and he's got some controversial opinions about AI. He's sitting for a remote interview with a newscaster, and in walks the Lady Cylon, like she's been there dozens of times before. And when the interview is over, they get right down to the fucking. And this fucking looks pretty spine-tingling when you see the behind her angle.
Yeah. She's got Karlak's infernal engine in there somewhere.
It's simply too hot to exist here in the material plane.
Is she wearing leather underwear?
Yeah, what an outfit, right? It's like kind of like a see-through top and skirt and then sort of a black leather bikini underneath for modesty.
There's an aspect to casting here that I think it's pretty important, because I don't think you just want to cast hot. You want to cast threat also. And the actor who plays this character, Trisha Helfer, like, really does that.
Yeah. There's sort of a Seven of Nine-iness to mm-hmm. this character, right?
Yeah.
I'm number six.
She's like so much taller than most of the characters that she's around, including Gaius Baltar. She just like seems more powerful than everybody.
Yeah.
And Gaius Baltar, controversial views on advancing computer technology and also on having sex with baby murdering robot ladies.
You gotta believe he's doing a good job if her spine turns red, right? Like that's good. It's a good sign, maybe, right?
I don't know. I've never gotten someone's spine red. I've had people try and like claim that their spine is red, but you know, like you look over and catch a glimpse in the mirror and you're like, come on.
Yeah.
Don't bullshit a bullshitter.
The greatest trick is yet to come.
We cut over to Galactica, and a Viper is entering the hangar. It's pilot Lee Adama. This is Captain Adama's son.
Another fucking Nepo baby.
I'm going to keep calling him Captain Adama where I shouldn't. Commander Adama.
Yeah.
The Edward James Olmos character.
Because Lee is the captain, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah. It's very confusing.
I got tripped up there. He doesn't like being there. He doesn't like landing his jet manually. But that's the way Commander Adama likes it. It doesn't sound like there was a choice in the matter. Like, the technology does not exist on this ship for whatever guided landing these jets can do.
And that was explained a little bit in that opener as well. Like, everything is wired. There's not wireless all over this ship.
Yeah.
There are computers, but not networked computers. And the ship is kind of intentionally not heavily reliant on automation because the Cylons threatened that type of vulnerability specifically.
Don't you love the detail of dot matrix printers being the most visual form of that?
Hey, stop looking at my can.
Yeah, I did sort of want, like, you know, spoiler alert for later in the episode, but, you know, Caprica starts getting exploded later, and I sort of wanted there to just be a hail of little, like, corners of pieces of paper falling everywhere,
sure.
You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Because that's the other thing, is they clip the corners off of every piece of paper in this show. And presumably there's just like a dump somewhere full of those paper corners, right?
Have you noticed that some brands of premium toilet paper, like the kind that I keep in my house, are not doing straight line cuts, they're doing a wavy cut?
Oh.
Because the idea is it's a cleaner pull when you pull it off the roll.
Wow.
Like it just blurps right across instead of like sometimes you'll pull the toilet paper and it'll like flub blub 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 blub, like it'll just roll on out on you in an annoying way.
Yeah, or you just get a little bit of corner from the next piece.
This seems like that. Like if you create your dot matrix printer paper in this format, maybe it's easier to rip off the printer.
Oh shit, but also, you know, we just recently on the hit Star Trek podcast, The Greatest Generation, opened a gift from a viewer in the UK who lovingly recreated the Coast Emojin like Paw Wraith book from Deep Space Nine.
Yeah.
And that has also got the corners clipped off.
How about that?
Maybe these people are Paw Wraith people.
Remains to be seen.
Yeah, who knows?
So there's a very brief moment where the crew chief is seen fooling around with a lieutenant that we know a little bit more about later on. And this is right next to a flight crew meeting that's happening. Lee Adama arrives, and boy, we got a great big surprise for you, Lee Adama. You're going to love it. You're going to get to fly your dad's old Viper during the ceremony. And everyone like does that thing where you're in a crowded room and like everyone turns around to look. And they're expecting to see a son filled with pride, you know, at being given the opportunity to do this great thing.
Yeah.
He's not happy about this at all. And everyone seems kind of put off by how not into it he is.
Apollo came aboard the Battlestar with a chip on his shoulder and carries that chip through this whole meeting. And it seems like he's got some pals in this room, like people he knows from other postings or whatever. But he's not happy to be here, despite the fact that this does really seem to be an honor that he's being given to, like, fly this Viper in this ceremony.
Yeah. kind of don't like his shit attitude right away. Like this isn't a character that's introduced to like in the way that so many others have been, right?
Right. For example, Robot Lady and Gaius, who we cut over to see on Caprica, they're walking around. We learn that, so Gaius Baltar is this like computer genius who works with the Ministry of Defense and has been advocating for greater embrace of artificial intelligence in a society that is still licking its wounds 40 years after a brutal war with artificial intelligences. Becomes clear that he's really opened up the computational kimono to the blonde lady in terms of letting her see what's going on in the Department of Defense's computer systems.
Was that so hard?
He believes that she is part of some kind of company that's going to be bidding for defense contracts.
When I open up my computational kimono, you can see 2 zeros and a 1.
Is that one kind of hanging in front of the zeros, or is it like up above the zeros?
Right in the middle.
Wow. Good for you.
This seems to be like a situation where he has a lot of power and she's got career ambitions and he's kind of helping her out. You know, it feels like a little bit innocent in that way, in a way that Gaius Baltar can't possibly know the truth about. Like, he thinks it's one way, but it is really not.
He just thinks it's quid pro dome.
Yeah. Yeah. And when he leaves, she turns around and talks to someone who isn't there or who we never see.
Mm-hmm. And that's going to be something that's more a thing for his character going forward.
I mean, I think that's probably something that attracted him to her because as we've said many times before on this show, nobody fucks like crazy. Over on Galactica, Laura Roslin arrives with a real Cousin Greg kind of assistant with her.
I can take a lot in terms of psychological pain, so yeah.
I love this guy.
Yeah.
I love that not everyone in science fiction has like a natural understanding of how ships work or how to navigate them or whatever. Of course he finds his way to the bathroom.
Yeah.
The co-ed shower area.
Yeah. He walks into a scene from Starship Troopers and is like, whoa!
Yeah.
What's going on in here?
This guy's great.
Yeah, and we also get to see some of the hangar area that is going to be the main part of the museum, like visitor information system and, you know, signs hanging and exhibits getting set up and stuff. One of the few, like, illustrations of the museum that this ship is scheduled to become. Meanwhile, Laura Roslin, the Mary McDonnell character, is getting toured around, and we kind of learn that she is the Secretary of Education, and she is the kind of like lead dignitary for this ceremony that everybody's been getting ready for. So
she's got pretty reasonable requests, right? She's like, look, if this is going to be a museum ship, we're going to be taking children's field trips through here constantly. And you know what children's field trips like? Little computer stations.
Yeah.
Why don't we set them up all over the place? And boy, Adama has a pretty bright line against this idea. I love how extremely clear he is about not ever having network computers on his ship in a way that, again, like walks up to being an asshole and takes two steps back from it. He's not being an asshole. He's just stating an opinion he has very strongly. And also it's his ship and those are his orders.
He's just being unequivocal.
Yeah.
There's nothing wrong with that.
No.
I'm sorry that I'm inconveniencing you or the teachers, but I will not allow a network computerized system to be placed on this ship while I'm in command. Is that clear?
Yes, sir.
Thank you. Excuse me.
Everyone's jacking off with paper stuff, right? Like, that's what's going on this ship?
Excuse me. That's Vanessa and that's mine.
Like a good 25% of the mass of this ship is just...
It's paper porn.
Yeah, reams of paper porn.
Paper porn with the corners of the pages cut off.
Right. So it doesn't like stack perfectly, you know?
Yeah.
Like from a space efficiency standpoint, they could be doing better, but they're not because they're committed to an aesthetic.
If you were wondering if Gaius Baltar was exclusive with his blonde lady friend, He is not. And we learn that in the next scene when he is woken up by his blonde lady friend while he's in bed with a different lover. And he tries to make the case that this is just who I am, baby. You knew this about me when you started hooking up with me and you asked me if I loved you. And I very definitely said I did not. You remember that, right?
I told you when we got together, baby, that you were going to have to share me with every other lady on this planet.
Yeah. She is not upset for the reasons you might presume. She's not mad. She just really needs to tell him something. Yeah. We don't get to hear what that is because we're back on Galactica again and it's picture day. Like, the press is a big part of this show at this point. The press is covering the decommissioning of the ship and they want to take pictures of the commander and his son. And they're kind of assuming a relationship that isn't there in a way that really makes a lot of sense, makes a lot of awkward sense. Like, why don't you put your arm around him, right? Because he's your son or whatever.
We learned from a brief scene in the brig where Apollo went to visit his old pal Starbuck that he and his dad are both grieving the loss of his brother, the other little boy from that photograph, mm-hmm. and grieving in ways that have kind of driven them apart as people. So that is especially uncomfortable in this scene. Like, yeah. They haven't even talked to each other in 2 years and they're being asked to like chum it up for the cameras. And I think they like barely sell it. I thought that the acting in this was really good. Like, they did the smile that they needed to do to get these people out of the room, mm-hmm. but neither of them liked doing it. And then they have a little confrontation.
I like how we don't cut away after that picture. Like, I like how we get right into it after the press leaves.
Yeah, and like it's Apollo saying like, hey, like there was nothing in my orders about being like congenial with my estranged father when I came aboard. Like, I didn't ask to be here. I'm here because this is where I was told to go and that's how my life works.
And also, my brother was a shitty pilot and never should have been a pilot if it weren't for your string pulling. So you killed my brother. It really ramps up the heat here pretty fast between them.
Yeah. Being a Nepo baby worked out great for me, but not for Zach. It bit back for Zach.
This is one of those scenes that's blocked in that way where Edward James Olmos's character is like looking toward the camera while over his shoulder, his son is kind of looking at him and us too. And like in the real life composition of this moment, like they're not looking at each other.
Right.
The son is just talking to his father's back.
When my wife and I have a difference of opinion and I attempt this move to make real this very classic framing from film and television.
Which one are you, the son or the father in this example?
I'm the one like looking off into the distance wistfully while I have the argument.
Sure.
Doesn't go over great.
Yeah.
We need to score a lot of land fast.
Licensed businessman.
This is Biz, and this is the final season of One Bad Mother, a comedy podcast about parenting. This is going to be a year of celebrating all that makes this podcast and this community magical.
I'm so glad that I found your podcast.
I just cannot thank you enough for just being the voice of reason as I'm trying to figure all of this out.
Thank you, and cheers to your incredible show and the vision you had to provide this space for all of us.
This is still a show about life after giving life. And yes, there will be swears. You can find us on MaximumFun.org. And as always, you are doing a great job.
All right, class. Tomorrow's exam will cover the science of cosmic rays, the morals of art forgery, and whether or not fish can drown. Any questions? Yes, you in the back. What is this?
It's the podcast Let's Learn Everything,
where we learn about science and a bit of everything else. My name's Tom. I study cognitive and computer science, but I'll also be your teacher for intermediate emojis.
My name's Caroline, and I did my master's in biodiversity conservation, and I'll be teaching you intro to things the British Museum stole.
My name's Ella. I did a PhD in stem cell biology, so obviously I'll be teaching you the history of fan fiction.
Class meets every other Thursday on Maximum Fun.
So do I still get credit for this?
No.
Obviously not.
No.
It's a podcast.
We cut right back over to Gaius Baltar's bedroom, where his Cylon lady friend has admitted to him that she's a Cylon, in case his dick didn't notice. Mm-hmm. And her access to the defense mainframe really freaks him out, but in a very unusual way. Not in the, oh my God, I put Caprica and the 12 colonies at risk, but rather in the, it's all my fault and everyone's going to find out it's all my fault kind of way. And she latches right on to how ugly this moment is for him, like as an expression of how ugly human beings can be.
Yeah, like it's not you that got fucked. I mean, you did get fucked, but your entire species got fucked here. And you're just, and all you can do is think about yourself.
He starts freaking out about treason and so forth. And it's almost redundant to describe it as cold, but like the coldness with which she describes a not so distant future where he won't be charged with any crimes because there will be no criminal justice system left to prosecute him is amazing. And like the bombs start falling on the planet right then and there.
Yeah, there's kind of a flash and we cut away, but it is hard to interpret that flash as anything but a nuke going off over the horizon.
What do you think about the choice to make this moment beautiful? Because I thought it was. Like, the way the flash happens over the ridgeline and, like, how beautiful this guy's house is, and these two actors are very pretty. Like, everything about this scene is, if you weren't listening to the dialogue, kind of breathtaking.
I love that choice. I think that the tension of that is really interesting and great. And yeah, like it warms up the scene too. Like the flash is very yellow and it kind of, you know, like I think this was probably shot in and around Vancouver, if I had to guess. And the like view out that window is like, you know, very fancy houses on Puget Sound or whatever, where you're, you know, looking across water at other islands, but it's kind of a cold climate, so it's a cool color temperature out there. Mm-hmm. And then that explosion kind of like warms it all up, gives it a beachy vibe.
Yeah, I like that choice too.
We cut over to the Battlestar Galactica for the decommissioning ceremony, where we get the flyby with the Vipers.
And the music is the theme to the original show. Wasn't that neat?
I thought that was great.
Yeah.
A proud moment for everyone, and Commander Adama gets introduced, and he kind of starts in on the speech that he was practicing before, and then he goes off script, man, and it's like, you know, it's one of those like, oh, the teleprompter's broke, and this is not going to be good. Like, this is going to be Gaff City.
One of my favorite SNL sketches is Wake Up and Smile, a sketch from like the mid-90s where the teleprompter goes out. You remember that? And it turns into Lord of the Flies.
Yeah.
The order of the hand will rule!
I really love how this moment unfolds, because this is like part of the greatness of what a Ronald D. Moore can do is like he can write toward the text and the subtext at the same time.
Right.
And what happens here is like he allows this character to speak towards this general audience, which is assembled in the hangar for like the museum shit. But when we cut over to his son listening along in the fighter plane, he's also talking specifically to him. And what he's saying is accomplishing both things.
Sooner or later, the day comes when you can't hide from the things that you've done anymore.
You know, it sort of feels like the apology he seems to think he owes his son for getting Zach into the military, I guess.
Is his name really Zach? That's such a classic name for a younger brother or something. Younger dipshit bad pilot brother.
Yeah. This speech also seems to hit for Starbuck. I mean, like we kind of cut around, like everybody's listening in on this, but I really like that this ceremony seems to be something that's important to the people that are here on Battlestar Galactica, but didn't really seem to be something anybody was thinking about on Caprica.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's just one of like a million ribbon cutting things that a secretary of blank goes and does throughout the course of their day. And like rarely are they like newsworthy events, you know?
Right. Like the decommissioning of a great aircraft carrier hits a lot harder in Norfolk than it does in right. any other part of the country.
Yeah, I'm sure it happens from time to time. I've never like opened a newspaper and sure. seen an item about it, you know.
Sure. Yeah.
So yeah, this feels like a kind of a moment that's very important to these characters specifically, but not really anyone else. And, you know, the Secretary of Education applauds, and then like we see her space jumbo jet leaving the hangar in the next moment. Like, it's over, and she's heading back to Caprica in this ship that has, like, there's a deck that is very much designed like a commercial airliner, but it also has, like, a big cargo capacity underneath. And they're getting escorted by Apollo in his vintage airplane.
They're all going back to the same place.
Yeah. And meanwhile, Boomer, the Grace Park character, and all of the rest of the Vipers are in space, you know, post the air show as part of the decommissioning ceremony. And they bid them farewell also. And we cut back to Caprica, where Dr. Gaius Baltar is really feeling bad for himself while he watches the end of society on TV.
Amazing how long cable news hangs in there before finally blurping out, right? Like, like the bombs are dropping all around his location on the planet, and like he's still getting channels on the TV. That's amazing.
Yeah.
Our internet goes out for no reason at all.
Our power has been going out for no reason at all lately. Like, just like really? Over, like we get up in the morning and like the clock on the stove is flashing.
I don't like that.
Yeah, it's happened like three times in the last few weeks.
Huh. So once Gaius loses the feed on the cable news, his Cylon lady friend makes it clear that like she's not in any danger. She's very Borg's queenie in this way. She's like, look, I can't die. This body, this hot body, like it's not over for me. I mean, it is in this body that's here with you, like that's going to go away, obviously, but I'm going to wake up somewhere else in a body just like it because there are 12 of me and I'm the sixth one, which I'm not sure if what she's saying is they've already blown up five of them before her, but I kind of feel like that's what she's saying because we saw one explode with that old crusty mouthed guy in the cold open.
Was that number five, presumably?
Yeah, and then we're about to lose this one. So the next time we see her is going to be seven, whenever that is.
It's a beautiful name for a boy or a girl, especially girl or a boy.
The Cylons have been spending these bodies like it's going out of style, though. Like, if there's only 12 of them, she's not totally unkillable.
But if her mission is just to do the pre-war, pre-attack stuff, they don't need many more than what they've got, it seems. Like, they're doing just fine with this plan.
Mm. Yeah.
But it is weird that they did not overbuild this particular model. Like, their manufacturing abilities seem pretty impressive, you know?
So is the next one go around introducing herself as 7 of 12?
Potentially, yeah.
Wow, weird.
How would you feel about 7?
Imprecise, but acceptable.
He's got nowhere to go, basically. But the bombs keep falling, and we cut back to Battlestar, where the news has not really reached them yet that really bad shit is going down. And finally, a call comes into Adama in his office that Fleet Headquarters is broadcasting a message in the clear about this Cylon attack on the 12 colonies. So he orders everyone to, you know, go to battle stations and... I mean, the ship is like half demilitarized at this point. Like, one of their hangar bays is occupied by museum crap and a gift shop, and they don't have any ammunition aboard. The alarm goes off, and everybody is taken totally by surprise, including the XO, who's just like trying to chill out and burn holes in photographs of his wife's face with a cigar.
I mean, what else is he going to do? He's probably not invited to that card game anymore.
Yeah.
He will not believe this until Commander Adama just goes on the 1MC and tells everyone that they're at war. That's what it takes to sort of like grab him by the lapels and shake him into understanding how severe this moment is. Also, it's time to get Starbuck out of the brig, right?
Yeah. I loved that he thought it was like a retirement prank. How fucking humiliating would that be? Yeah. That's what it actually was.
All of that affection that the crew showed him earlier just is quickly betrayed by like their interest in doing bits on him.
Really? A life of military service is not known for enriching one. I did this out of love and respect for you guys, and this is your fucking tally-ho to me? This is how you send me off?
Do you think it's fun and funny for me to think at any point that my one remaining son might be in danger of going to war right now? Who thought of this? There's also an attack squadron from Galactica that's 2 hours away from Caprica. Like, they're en route.
Yeah, these are the people that Boomer and Hilo were with. Boomer and Hilo are in a bigger ship that is like a similar design to the Vipers, but has maybe some troop-carrying capacity and some extra cargo capacity.
They call this a Raptor.
Oh, okay. They start picking up bogeys on their radar. They're starting to think that maybe there's some Cylons that may be nearby.
I love how much of the battle you don't see. Like, what have we seen up until now? We've seen one nuclear explosion. We've seen some grainy television news footage.
Right.
But it's this moment on Galactica where we get, like, the war update, and we get to learn of the losses. Like, a quarter of the fleet's been destroyed. 30 battle stars of the kind that Galactica is have been destroyed.
But presumably, like, newer than the kind that Galactica is, because Galactica's from the era of the war.
Right.
So this is having really devastating effects, and Starbuck kind of swags onto the bridge and gets this terrible news and wants to get one of those Mark II Vipers out of mothballs and get into the fight.
I think that thing you said about how the advancement in technology is actually been what is their Achilles heel is, like, not directly described here, but like, they're reading instant reports about Battlestar's losing power before they're even able to attack,
right,
or repel the Cylons. Like, that's a big part of the subtext of like the mystery of how their losses have been so great.
And it seems like Robot Babe number 6 may be behind that, and Gaius Baltar, through idiocy, also sort of at fault for that kind of stuff. And we see this vividly described in the fight that these Vipers have with, it's just two Cylon planes that they go up against, and they all get taken out kind of all at once because their computers bonk out and their ships are, you know, not steerable. And Boomer and Hilo, like, just watch this from a distance, helpless to do anything. And it's a really scary moment.
I got to say that the first time I saw this, it really, really bumped me, because these Cylon fighters look like Cylon heads put on the front of the ships in a very Maximum Overdrive kind of way. I thought it was cheesy, but like, the more you live in this series and consume its episodes, I think the more terrifying it becomes. Like, it makes a kind of cold logic kind of sense that, like, yeah, that's what they look like. And the like Knight Rider red sweeping light across the front, like, it's a total throwback.
Yeah,
but it really works.
It is very Knight Rider, like,
yeah.
You do it so well. Thank you.
It's kind of nauseating to see, like, when the squadron loses power and see them kind of float lifelessly and, like, bonk into each other and stuff. Like, we talk all the time about how scary it is to encounter a starship in Star Trek that is just kind of tumbling in space or listing or whatever, and how gross that looks.
Yeah.
This is that.
It's totally that. And we don't know these ships that well.
Yeah.
But they totally get the same effect. So we cut over to the civilian transport that's taking Mary McDonnell et al. Back to Caprica. And she's, like, in the bathroom, like, she's having a terrible day. She's had to kind of, like, put on a brave public face while knowing that she is been diagnosed with some terrible sickness.
And it seems like no one around her knows of this diagnosis either. This is private at this point, right?
Yeah. And she like walks out into the ship and the captain of the ship is like giving everyone an update. Like she is not keeping up with current events. Like this is the first she's hearing about any of this stuff.
Yeah. This is like if you were somehow able to miss the scene in the newsroom where the pilot comes and tells the people in first class that they got Osama bin Laden and everyone starts cheering. Like if you're a character on that show that happened to miss that moment.
Yeah.
This is that.
It's
Rosalind missed that moment.
I'm sorry. What did he say?
Yeah.
What was that about? Meanwhile, Boomer and Hilo are getting shot at by the Cylons, and they manage to use countermeasures on the missiles, but they get grazed a little bit, and it fucks their ship up, and they're like losing fuel, and Hilo takes some shrapnel through his leg.
This looks very painful.
Yeah. Boomer comes up with the idea that they're basically just going to have to coast back to Caprica and put the ship down on the planet's surface. And they have no idea like how fucked up the situation is going to be when they get there.
Yeah, it makes some sense that that's where they would ditch, but yikes.
Yeah.
The debris field is maybe the first time you start to see the scale of the attack, because we've not seen city skyline. We haven't seen much, but like there are tumbling carcasses of ships up there that they're flying unpowered through.
Right.
On their way toward the surface.
Very Wolf 359.
Back on Galactica, Adama gives another update to the crew. Caprica City, no longer going to be hosting the Super Bowl. And they're not going to be able to move that to a lot of other colonies either. Nukes have been detonated in a number of cities, on a number of planets. And aboard Rosalind's transport, she tells the flight crew that someone on board with the radio has heard this. And the pilot is forced to admit that it's true. And when your pilot is scared, that's scary. And yeah. It's noticeable how cool Rosalind is in this moment. She wants to be the one to address the passengers. And she goes and she does that.
This is a very interesting thing about this episode, because I think that the kind of terminology of government that they use in it, like the fact that she's the Secretary of Education, which is a job that we roughly understand what it means. And, you know, when they talk about there's like a line of succession, these ideas were familiar from seeing political thrillers, but also the captain giving the vibe of an airline captain.
Yeah.
Like, this is a sci-fi scenario that is very easy for us to get our hands around emotionally, like what these characters are going through, because they map really easily onto things from real life without many, you know, hurdles you have to go through. And also, you know, I mean, Mary McDonald's just like an incredible actor. So
yeah.
She just brings so much life to these moments, and she's got to call in because as a member of the cabinet, like there are procedures when something like the capital city has been nuked happens.
I like how quickly things pivot to a very realistic feeling triage. Like, all right, well, our destination is kind of no longer there. So we're going to have to hunker down on this transport ship for a while. Let's prep it for a longer term voyage than we were expecting. Like she starts delegating tasks immediately here.
I love this. Like she just is taking the leadership bull by the horns. Like Doral speaks up for a second and she nut stomps him and gives him a job like immediately. She's like, who the fuck are you? I'm the fucking Secretary of Education. Name somebody with a higher rank on this ship.
I think one of the best ways to diffuse this type of person or this type of angle is like, do you want to help? Here's how you do that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, shut the fuck up and help. Like, grab a shovel.
Tear up some water. Boil some rags.
I'm sure the child will arrive soon.
Yeah. On the flight deck, there is a... I think you were talking about this before, like the process of government in this form and the check that must be done for the succession plan that needs to take place in a time of war like this.
Yeah. She learns that... an unconditional surrender was offered to the Cylons and ignored.
This is like playing Civ and you're Gandhi and you're really going at the other countries with the nukes and so forth. And they will give you anything for peace. And
yeah, it's like, amazing.
Nope, I'm going for war victory.
I'm playing this the way Computer Gandhi used to play this.
Yep.
So one of these missiles is coming for their ship, and Apollo bravely convinces the nuke to lock onto him instead of lock onto the big transport, and succeeds in shooting it down. We cut over to the surface of Caprica, where Boomer and Hilo have set down. Hilo's just working on getting his tourniquet working while Boomer like wrenches under the ship. I think they said something about like a fuel line getting clipped. So
there's kind of a suction cup device that he uses to seal a hull breach. And I was like, oh, why couldn't you just blurp that onto your gushing wound? Seal that up.
Yeah. Do you think some fuel got into the wound? Like, did the shrapnel carry fuel into his birdie?
I don't know. It's ugly. They did a great job with this wound.
Yeah, because if it did, like, just light the fuel on fire, cauterize everything.
Their problem isn't just fixing the ship to take off. Their problem also becomes what to do with the mob of refugees that are running down the Michael Bay-esque field of wheat just outside of the city center. They're carrying their bags and their books and their children and all that.
Yeah.
Going to be a problem.
And there's like, you know, mushroom clouds all around them in every direction.
And there's a Gaius Baltar in there.
Yeah.
I guess he survived by holding close to his Cylon girlfriend's legs like a nanny.
I like the one guy who didn't, you know, put anything in suitcases, but did grab a stack of books. Like, we got to preserve the knowledge of Caprica.
We got to talk about stack of books, guy. How far are you running with a stack of books that tall before you're just losing books?
Because it's not like stack of books that you can hold with two hands. It's stack of books that he is managing partly using his chin. And he is running full speed through a field.
It's an insane choice for an insane time. I can't judge it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's true. And like, maybe those are really important books in their culture. You know, who knows?
Behind him is his wife, like, Mitch, would you mind, like, carrying one of our children? That would be great.
How much do those books weigh? Like, 30 pounds total? I got two toddlers here.
Yeah.
Each one of which is 30 pounds. Apollo has put in to the cargo bay on the civilian ship, which... I was shocked at how big this cargo bay was. I was thinking that this was like commercial airliner size of vessel, and it is way, way bigger than that.
Because the main cabin part feels like that. It feels small.
And that sort of made me realize how big the Battlestar is, because this ship was a little thing that could go into the hangar bay of the Battlestar and set down.
Yeah.
No problem. So the Battlestar is fucking enormous.
Yeah, it's really... Russian nesting dolls up in here.
Yeah, so Apollo's ship, I guess, got a little bit damaged by his encounter with the missiles, and Doral's down here, and he's like, oh, like this horrible lady that's the Secretary of Education has been calling the shots, so I'm really glad you're here because you've actually got a rank in the military and you can overrule her, and we can actually be led by somebody that I believe to be competent.
What a little ratty fuck.
Yeah. And I love how quickly he regrets doing this. Like when Apollo goes up and sees that Mary McDonnell is just fucking running shit and like doing a super good job at it. Apollo's like, that lady is in charge.
I think lesser writing would have turned this into a confrontation instead of the example that this is. Like, like they just witness Rosalind's greatness and that's sufficient to make the point.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there isn't anything where she says something about how her genitals are on the inside of her body or anything like that.
Yeah, yeah. The meme of this is like the car sliding into the off-ramp And those two script choices being the exit signs.
To be honest, Darwin wishes she would have brought up the situation with her genitals.
Back on the surface of Caprica, these refugees seem to think that their money will do anything to get them a ticket on this ship that they've encountered, and it won't. This ship has a capacity, a weight capacity, that means that they've got room for the kids and three more non-kids. I thought this was a terrible choice. If you've got fall of humanity happening, what good is a kid going to do you? You need knowledge. You need people who can do shit. And a kid's not going to do anything.
Okay, we're going to take the kids, but not that one with the really tragic haircut. And we're going to take three adults and all the books that that guy is carrying.
Yeah. Yeah, I think taking the kids is a bad choice.
They do take the time to run this lottery. Like, like,
as nukes are falling all around them. What?
I was shocked by this.
Yeah.
Finally, over on the Battlestar, they launch a bunch of these Mark II Vipers, the old ones. But Starbuck doesn't get to go because her ship is not firing yet. And she is very, very eager to get into the fight.
I love the catapult system on Galactica. It's so recognizable as a form of technology.
Yeah.
And it's great when they do the cut from the tube that serves as the launch system to the exterior to show you the scale when these ships are launched. I think it's great.
It really looks awesome. They're fighting another couple of these Cylon ships, and finally Starbuck gets in the fight and starts bullseyeing targets. Very exciting, like, great dogfight sequence. I love the cockpit stuff, the control center stuff, the CG of the actual fight. All of it is done at a super high level. I think that one thing that I kind of feel like this pilot may have innovated is all the exterior stuff of spaceships sort of is shot on kind of a handheld, the camera's like pop zooming in and out basis.
Yes. Like, yeah, yeah, yeah.
This is a look that they definitely borrowed in The Expanse and a few other sci-fi shows that I've watched.
Great call.
I kind of think it must start here. Like, maybe there are earlier examples of it, but this feels to me like the earliest example of it. And, you know, like, there's not obviously not a camera guy with a camera on his shoulder zooming in and out and like floating around in space. But something about like adding a little bit of float to the camera and making those shots a little bit more chaotic and handheld feeling makes space feel bigger and scarier, you know?
Did you also detect, as a way to kind of finish this effect, something that they were doing with the audio too? The only way I can come up to describe it is like when you jump into a pool, what being in water sounds like, or... like, was there a frequency to the sound of being in space that sounded like white noise adjacent? Like, there's something acoustically happening when you're out there combined with these camera angles and movements that really make it feel interesting. And it feels like you're in space in the way that they want you to feel.
Yeah, like, obviously in space no one can hear you scream, but you do want to have sound just for, like, the excitement of the viewing experience. And they made interesting and... new choices, I feel like, in both the visuals and the audio. Just the, like, distortion on the radios sounds really cool in this.
Yeah.
So they're taking out these Cylon ships, but one of them gets off a shot. I think it's three nukes, and Starbuck is able to take out a couple of them, but one of them is able to detonate near the Galactica, and this sets off a whole, like, submarine film sequence where there's a big section of the ship and an argument about shutting the bulkheads to isolate it from the rest of the ship.
Whether or not Steve Zahn is inside or outside that area.
Yeah, like Chief Tyrell is like, I got 100 Zahns down there. And Colonel Teague is like, make their lives count for something.
You have your orders. Now seal a goddamn bay before we all go down.
Initially, I thought this was happening in a different part of the ship from the bridge, like far away from it. But it is revealed during this interaction and afterward that, like, this is just off to the side. This is as if this conversation was happening at Worf's tactical station. Like, right. This is an earshot of everyone.
Yeah, it's a big confrontation, and it's like, I think it's an interesting moment for the Colonel Teague character, because it's like, not felt like he is trustworthy or competent at all up until this point. And he just seems like a cruel and shitty boss that is like stuck in middle management under the actual boss that everybody likes.
Yeah.
And you sort of realize in this moment, like, this is why he has the job he has, because he is capable of making a really shitty decision, you know, at the drop of a hat and ordering the bad thing.
This happens in publicly traded companies all the time before the venture capital vultures take them down piece by piece. Like, they install a managerial figure to like give the bad news and destroy from the inside so that they can be the face of the thing. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of like what's happening here.
Yeah, he's that guy.
Last three slots on the Viper ship, Ben.
I think this is so well written, because like they start calling the numbers, and the lady that's got the last ticket is like, I can't see. I don't have my glasses. Her glasses are on her head, first of all.
To snatch seriousness from the jaws of humor the way that they do here, I think is really great. Because this shouldn't have worked. This was fun and funny, but it was not.
There's so many dimensions to this, because you're like, oh man, like, this guy is Baltar, such an asshole that he's going to like claim that this was his ticket and be like, oh ma'am, like, you had 46, but I happen to have 47. And he doesn't do that. Instead, he gets recognized by Hilo, who is like, okay, like, old lady who has the number and you can both go, because I'm going to sacrifice myself to save the great Dr. Gaius Baltar, because I've seen you on TV and I know you're important.
Well, doesn't it seem as though Gaius's character has changed? Because he has that opportunity, not only declines to take the opportunity, but like foists her ahead of him. Like, you gotta get on that transport, lady. And also, get the fucking glasses off your head and actually use them.
I mean, it's like the nightmare scenario that we talk about all the time. You and your wife are going on a flight somewhere, and one of you, but not the other, gets bumped up to first class.
Yeah.
And it's like, no, you should take it. Like, I really want you to enjoy. And it's like, I'm not so sure. And like, all of that tension is in this scene.
There's a little checkbox on Delta where it's like, yeah, if you have an upgrade, I'll take one of those. There should be another checkbox that's, don't break up my marriage. That should be a button you hit.
That should be a button.
And look, if your marriage is on the rocks, and maybe like this would be the thing to tip it over, maybe you don't click that button.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe you let it happen. Maybe you blame it on Delta.
Some air travelers just want to watch the world burn.
Yeah.
Hilo self-sacrifices and also like shoots a guy in the back who's trying to like last copter out of Nam his way on. Like, you're not going to make it very far, guy getting on the outside of the spaceship.
You know? There is like 10 pounds of Boston butt that fly off of this guy's side body. I thought like he was not just shot with a laser weapon. It like really fucked him up.
Yeah. Yeah. You're going to want to go slow and low on the chunk of that guy that flew off.
Yeah. Yeah.
RSVP, Hilo, and all other people that live on Caprica.
Was that Books guy? Can we just say that it was?
Yeah, let's...
The guy who ditched the books and tried to get on?
Let's assume it was Books guy.
Yeah.
He seems to have made a lot of bad decisions today.
Yeah.
I mean, he's no Gaius Baltar in terms of bad decision making.
His story ended there.
So it's starting to look like Mary McDonnell is the designated survivor. They get like a automated message over on the spaceship, and she sends something back. She has a little conversation with Apollo about like what's going on here. That's when she like gets the little printout that reveals that in fact the presidency has fallen to her.
The ceremony when she's sworn in, I think it intentionally evokes Lyndon Johnson swearing in on Air Force One. Like, it's happening on this transport ship.
Right.
As if Jackie Kennedy were being was taking the oath of office instead, like right on down to the similarities in dress. Mm. I thought this scene was really well done for that reason.
I thought it was weird that the scroll that the priest lady was reading off was like very vascular. Seemed like a very horny scroll, didn't it?
I mean, some priests prefer the meat scroll,
yeah,
like for the big events.
Right.
But why was this priest traveling with the meat scroll? It would seem as though this is just like a normal, like you bust out the meat scroll for the big ones, not right. Whatever this was going to be.
How did she get past TSA with the meat scroll? That's what I want to know.
I don't know. Pretty gross.
Yeah. Nasty.
On Galactica, Adama is told of the very high death count that came as a result of Teague's command. And also, like in the very same conversation, the munitions depot has a ton of the stuff they need. Trouble is, between them and that depot, the Cylon fleet. And that's like 3 days away. How are they going to get there?
We learned that they do have faster than light travel in this sci-fi universe, but it is super fucking scary and everybody does not like doing it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Fascinating. I love this. Like, I love the idea. It's like, yeah, it's built into a lot of these ships, but we'd really rather not.
I mean, due to its age and that it hasn't been activated in decades, right? Like, that's the thing that really gives people pause.
Yeah.
When you get a barn find, like, the problem with these things are all the plastic and rubber parts that disintegrate from sitting there. And that's
right.
That's the problem with this drive system.
Yeah. I mean, the paint job is in immaculate shape. Like, you can't believe it, but there's no way it's drivable without
exactly.
A lot of work.
Yeah.
So they're getting ready to do this. Chief Tyrol comes up to Adama and is like, man, did you see what Colonel Teague made me do? Like, what the fuck, man? Like, that guy sucks. And Adama stands by his lieutenant. He's like, that guy made a really hard decision. If I had been in his position, I probably would have made the same one. And it sucks, but we're in a war, man. Like, this is not make warm and fuzzy decisions that we're super psyched about time.
That's like just the perfect kind of leadership for that moment. Adama's like, I know you hate him, but you like me, right? Well, I would have done the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
So there it is. You think we lost some folks to those fires and the decompression? Just imagine what's going to happen when we go to hyperlight jump.
Yeah, like I kept like wanting somebody to raise that, like, sir, like the ship is pretty shredded. Like, we just took like a broadside from a nuclear weapon. Like, you sure we want to go that fast right now?
Wasn't that another thing that illustrated its size? Like, that was a high yield nuclear weapon that from the exterior just scarred a small part of the greater vehicle.
Yeah, this thing is buff.
It's like a rock chip to this thing.
We get a big speech from the captain here as they get ready to do this warp jump. And he gets on the 1MC and explains to everybody the big heap of shit that they are in. And that he is like taking over the fleet. He's seizing command of the military. And it doesn't seem like anybody is even alive to take exception to that.
I was thinking a lot about Star Trek First Contact when I was watching this pilot, because there are many scenes in this episode that I think are similar, but like, for instance, when Picard takes command of the fleet during that movie's Borg attack, like, he's flying his ship through the parts of those destroyed ships and taking command in that moment, like on the battlefield. And
right.
So much of what happens in this episode is done over radio, done very far away from where the action is. And very far away from, like, your sense of the destruction scale. Here's just
right.
a guy reading a report on a piece of paper going, well, I guess it's me, and I guess I better tell him. Like, it's a massive choice that he's making, but, like, the actual act of it is so minor. It's so nothing.
It's so understated, and I think it's understated because he is not playing it for gravitas or import. He is playing it for like, I guess this is what I got to do now.
There's never a moment in this show where he like stands up out of his chair, straightens his uniform, like takes that one Starfleet step to camera and like delivers the line in that moment. This isn't like that. Yeah. This isn't that kind of show.
No. So we get a little argument between him and the new president, Laura Roslin, because Commander Adama is advocating that everybody that still has FTL meet at this place where there's a munitions depot where they can arm up the fleet. And she's like, no, we're still saving stragglers. Like, there's survivors out here in space and we're trying to grab them. And you're focused on like getting stuff to shoot. Like, that's kind of like not the point at this point. We are lifeboats now, man.
Yeah. This is a real go-around that Adama wants to do. Like, he knows Roslin is on the rechristened Colonial One presidential ship. Yeah. But he also knows his son is over there, too. And when he radios that ship, he does not radio her. He radios him.
Yeah.
And he repeats the order. And Lee Adama's like, yeah, we heard you. And the newly christened fleet commander takes great umbrage with this.
Yeah.
We're in the middle of a war. And you're taking orders from a school teacher?
And they start to interrupt. This happens a couple times this episode. They're interrupted by Cylon fighters inbound. And the president doesn't want to leave these damaged ships behind while there's people that can still be rescued. And so Lee goes down to where his fighter is and gets on board. And the sequence of cutting back and forth between the elder Adama and his son, both prepping and getting on his jet and flying out and engaging the Cylons, is maybe the most dynamic sequence of the episode. Like, all of the violence of what happens in this episode is so understated and so distant. This is the moment where, like, the patter of that really goes back and forth, right up to the point where Adama assumes that his son is dead.
You see a big explosion on the radar screen that they're all looking at, and the radar screen goes blank.
Hey, random crew person on the bridge, do we need to know the amount of kilotons in the bomb that took out the president and the captain's son? Like, is that really necessary right now? Like, right now?
Yeah, I mean, you get the sense that Colonel Teague might have his job because he does a real mean shoulder massage in times of crisis.
Yeah.
But yeah, that kiloton reporter guy, definitely not going to be rising through the ranks anytime soon.
Maybe put it in the printout.
Did you like the first half of the pilot of Battlestar Galactica, Adam?
I had forgotten how good this show is. I really, really loved it. And I think the best decision this show ever made was casting Ulmos and McDonnell, because when you combine actors like them with a script that allows them the space and the silence to emote the way they do, the way they're capable of.
Yeah.
Like, you don't just have a great science fiction show, you have a great show. And that kind of seems like the premise they were going off of. Like, let's make a great show that is also science fiction. And everyone's performance in this show is evidence of that to me. I think it just really feels like these are human beings living in this moment with all of their imperfect decisions and imperfect dialogue and real emotion here. It felt very real to me in a way that makes this show really one of my favorite shows.
Yeah.
And a really spectacular, we're not even talking about the whole pilot. We're just talking about the first half of it. Yeah. Like, the first half of this show's pilot is one of the best science fiction shows. What about you?
I agree. It's really great. I mean, like, they plowed a ton of money into this show. The fit and finish on the sets and the amount of care that is taken with the music and the sound design and the special effects and all of that stuff is like super impressive. And that's all in support of like really terrific performances by really compelling actors and in scenes that are like so interesting and multidimensional. And the fact that this is just the first half of this is like really mind blowing because it really feels like, man, like you tuned in night one for this, like this was, you know, shown over two nights on the Sci-Fi Channel or whatever. Like you are coming back for night two after this first 90 minutes.
Yeah. Yeah. I think the Marvel Cinematic Universe did that thing with the scale of horror that has just made it so enormous and puts you in such close proximity to it that it sort of doesn't read as horrible in the way that it should.
Yeah.
And this show seemed to understand that it's actually the distance from that scale that's the most effective. Like, you see Caprica from orbit and you see the flashes and shit. Like,
yeah.
I am so glad you're not in Caprica City watching the buildings fall. It's just, like, to be there for that is brain scrambling. But when you see it and experience it from a distance, like, you're actually able to feel what that might be like in an effective way.
And the chaotic feeling that so many of the characters have, like, not knowing where their loved ones are or what's going on.
Yeah.
And the way, like, you continue to see characters receive the news of what's going on. Like, it's so much more effective to watch Mary McDonald like walk into a moment where people are finding out about 9/11 style, you know, scene than it is to just show, you know, CG footage of buildings melting or whatever.
Yeah. Like, yeah,
when you are doing a really big high budget sci-fi event like this, you have the budget to show the buildings melting. It is careful restraint and good storytelling that they don't.
It's about a person's definition of awe. To a certain type of person, seeing the buildings fall over is the thing that will elicit that emotion. But I think a more interesting take on what that is the one from The Remove.
Yeah.
And I'm so glad that that decision was made here.
Yeah. I also like that there's like horny parts to it, like
sure,
lots of characters making out with each other and stuff. Like, I'm glad that Boomer's gonna have somebody to fall into the arms of when she gets back.
Yeah,
I think that maybe it would have been like a bridge too far to make the guy that was also on the jet with her and sacrificed himself, her lover. You know?
Right.
Like,
yeah.
Like, I don't know. Like, I think they did a great job in this first half also of just like making me curious about like 10 characters, you know. There are so many interesting people on this show, like people whose names you don't get, but you get close-ups of and you see them reacting to things over the course of the episode. And you're like, man, like, I can't wait to see what happens with that person, you know?
Yeah. It's quite a beginning to the thing.
And like half of those people are dead by the end of this first half, so you also feel like scared for all of them, you know?
Yeah, everyone's life is on the table here as a character in a really effective way.
Yeah.
Really well done.
Well, Adam, this would be the part of the show where we check our P1 inbox. Instead, we're going to do a little bit of a pledge break because it is the Max Fun Drive.
Priority one message from Starfleet coming in on secured channel.
Well, Adam, this episode came out during a Max Fun Drive, a Greatest Trek Drive, if you will. And so no P1s on today's episode, but if you'd like to get a P1 for a future episode, it's MaximumFun.org/Jumbotron. And if you'd like to support the show on an ongoing basis, it's MaximumFun.org/join to do that. Well, I have a question for you, Adam.
My answer is yes, 1,000 times yes.
Did you have yourself an Edward Larkin?
It's books, guy. I love finding the Larkin as we do the recap. I wasn't sure who my Larkin was going to be, but yeah. Definitely that fucking dork with the books fleeing a burning city. Hey, you know what would be great? In about 24 hours? Granola bars. A big stack of those.
I would have loved to have Books Guy be running, but then like the camera pans forward and there's a guy like way out ahead of him with one iPad.
That'd be great. How about you, Ben?
I'm going to give it to Dr. Gaius Baltar when his second lover is kind of shamed out of the room and is like, you know, wrapping the bedspread around herself, leaving so that he can be confronted by his other girlfriend that she didn't know about.
Uh-huh.
He goes, bye. In a way that is like very hopeful, like, oh, I hope to see you later.
Yeah, this is fun for both of us. I think we can agree. The scene we don't get happens like a half an hour later when she's having coffee with one of her girlfriends and she's like, God, you'll never believe what happened to me. I'm over at this guy's house and it's like the morning after and things went pretty well overnight. And then this fucking random chick shows up and I get kicked out. This is the worst day ever. And then white flash and then the scene ends and then we're on to another scene.
Come on, Ronald D. Moore, put one of those in. We said we didn't want to see Caprica City explode, but actually we did.
Her girlfriend's like in her monologues like, God, all she wants to do is talk about her own problems. She never asks about me.
Well, Adam, we're going to do a warning boy. We'll do something slightly different since this is a Max Fun Drive episode.
Prepare a buoy and launch it when ready.
Warning buoys.
An emergency buoy. A warning buoy.
Morning Buzz is, of course, the segment where we shout out something somebody posted online. It can come in the form of a 5-star review on Apple Podcasts or in the form of a social media post. But we really appreciate folks that do that because it super helps to get the word out about what we do here. I'm going to pick a message that was sent in about our show to Wendy. She compiled a big list of testimonials from viewers that support our shows on a monthly basis. And we're going to do warning buoys about that during the drive. So cool. This one is from Jason, and he's been a member since 2018. And Jason said, my favorite bonus content is Factory Seconds, but a close second is the Santa Monica Mountains podcast. I get the Baywatch theme stuck in my head for days after that. And I think that, like, maybe if you haven't heard all of our bonus content, you could be forgiven for being like, I don't know what that is. It sounds weird and not necessarily like it's for me. And we do review the Cheesecake Factory and episodes of Baywatch sometimes in the bonus feed. But we also do a ton of other stuff. If you've been enjoying Pilot Season, there is another Pilot Season episode in the bonus feed right now. And, you know, we've reviewed movies and other shows and had all kinds of different weird types of fun over the years. Dozens of hours of bonus content from me and Adam in that bonus feed. So get on board if that is a compelling warning bois to you.
I think that there's a point in every parasocial relationship between podcaster and viewer that sort of transcends the source material. From my interest, I'm talking personally, like my interest in what they're talking about to the host's relationships with each other, period. And I suspect if you have not listened to Factory Seconds or Santa Monica Mountains podcast, and yet you like Greatest Gen and Greatest Trek, you're going to like those shows.
I think you will.
They're Ben and Adam shows.
They are us.
So get into the bonus feed and support the shows to get those episodes.
Okay, well, we are obviously going to be covering part 2 of the Battlestar Galactica miniseries on the next episode of Greatest Trek.
Thank God.
Sure had a great time watching this first part, so I'm very much looking forward to that. Of course, right after that, we're going to be getting into Discovery. So, exciting stuff here on Greatest Trek, but that is the end of the episode for today, so we're going to leave it with Wendy from here.
Don't frack it up, Wendy.
Greatest Trek is an Uxbridge Shimoda podcast on the Maximum Fun Network. It's hosted by Ben Harrison and Adam Pranica, and it's produced and edited by Wendy Pretty. Next week on Pilot Season, it's the second part of the Battlestar Galactica miniseries. We're looking forward to that. And the USS Hood Discord server is still hosting a handful of weekly watch parties for these pilots, so head on over there to join in at drunkshimoda.com. If you've been enjoying pilot season or you appreciate all the great Star Trek coverage you get on this show, we are asking for you to get involved during the drive this year. It's an audience-supported podcast, so if you're able to contribute, please do it this week during the drive at MaximumFun.org/join. We really appreciate it. Thanks to Adam Ragusea, who composed the theme music for Greatest Trek. Check out what he's up to on YouTube by searching for Adam Ragusea. Thanks to Nick Ditmore for creating the show art, and thanks to Bill Tilley and Rob Adler for all their work managing the various social media pages that you can find and follow online, especially the Greatest Trek YouTube channel, which you should definitely get subscribed to. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next week on Greatest Trek.
Maximum Fun,
a worker-owned network
of artist-owned shows,
supported
directly
by you.